Okay. One more lecture left. I'm going to talk a little bit more about reheating, the decay of. We talked about single-field slow-roll inflation and how these fluctuations develop in the inflaton field. I'm going to talk about decay of the inflaton to the standard model and how fluctuations in the standard model fields are produced. As a warm-up, I was talking about a free massive scalar field in FRW. Ignoring spatial fluctuations, so I'm just solving ordinary differential equations in time, not partial differential equations. This is the approximation that this is what happens if I'm interested in modes whose wavelength is much larger than the current value of the horizon, as is true of modes on cosmological scales of cosmological interest today, well after they cross the horizon in inflation and well before they re-enter the horizon in our hot Big Bang. So here are the equations that describe this situation. The FRW density and pressure you just find by varying the action and working out the stress energy tensor. The equation of motion for phi you find by varying the action with respect to phi. And for the Hubble constant, I'm not assuming, so there's a guaranteed contribution to the Hubble constant from the scalar field itself, but I'm not assuming that this scalar field is the only particle in the universe. So if there are other species here, they'll come in as some contribution to h other squared to the total h squared. I identified these four regimes, and I had done one case, which is the case where the scalar field phi is a very subdominant contribution to the total energy of the universe. And the Hubble constant of the universe is much larger than the oscillation scale. And in that regime, we show that the oscillator is frozen on its potential. And so it just behaves as a source of potential energy or a cosmological constant, if you like, with W close to minus one. But now let's analyze the other regime, starting with this one. If H other is much larger than H phi, we can treat this H in the differential equation as some external function of time. So this is a linear differential equation. And the other thing we know is that this friction term is going to be small. The time scale where it's important is going to be small compared to M, the time scale of the oscillation. We might suppose that in this situation, H much less than M, we might suppose that on short time scales, like the oscillator time scale, this is a good approximation. But on long time scales, on the friction time scale, we start to see some damping. So if we look locally, we just see simple harmonic motion. But if we wait long enough, we'll see that the amplitude is decreased. So we have some sort of adiabatic situation where the oscillator is slowly losing energy. And to work out how quickly, let's calculate d rho dt using the exact equations of motion. So that's the time derivative of 1 half phi dot squared plus 1 half m squared phi squared, which is phi dot phi double. Let's write the answer this way, phi dot phi double dot plus m squared phi. By the exact equation of motion, that's the same thing with a minus 3h. Minus 3h phi dot in parentheses. So the rate at which you lose energy is proportional to phi dot squared times a small number. So if you look closely at d rho dt, a simple harmonic oscillator, of course, converts, the oscillation converts between phi dot and phi. So this is a phi dot squared is a function that oscillates on the oscillator time scale. And so you would see, so there's some negative, d rho dt is some something like this. You know, rho, if you look closely, has little wiggles. It decreases in little steps. But there's some envelope of the there's some average envelope here that we can compute if we average over times that are long compared to the oscillation time scale. Then we can assume that the average of phi dot squared is just rho itself. Okay. So averaged over a sufficiently long time scale, say a Hubble time scale, rho obeys the differential equation rho dot is minus 3h rho. Let's write it rho dot plus 3h rho equals 0. And then, you know, a nice way to solve this differential equation is to recognize the left-hand side as the time derivative of a cubed rho with a a to the minus 3 on the outside. Which tells you that rho is proportional to a to the minus 3. In other words, in this regime, when the Hubble constant drops below m and the oscillator unfreezes, an oscillator oscillating around its zero point with no significant Hubble friction or subdominant friction term behaves as pressureless non-relativistic matter. Oh, thanks. I could tell by all the mumbling that I was doing something wrong, but I didn't know what it was. So rho is proportional to a to the minus 3, or w is 0. Okay. That's also what you might guess, you know, in this picture where you have sort of an adiabatic dying out oscillator, you might guess that phi dot squared and m squared phi squared are of the same order of magnitude on average, or equal on average, so that p is averages to 0, which is another way of saying that the equation of state is 0. Okay, now let's talk about these other situations. Let's talk about this one first. The case where the scalar field phi dominates the stress energy of the universe. So we can pretend, for purposes of integrating its equation of motion, that it's the only species. And that the value of phi is such that the Hubble constant is much larger than the mass scale m. So we could analyze this regime from scratch. But as a shortcut, let me just point out that we've already analyzed the situation in more generality when we analyzed slow roll single field inflation. So this is just a special case. This regime is just a special case of slow roll single field inflation. You might sort of guess that because, you know, slow roll single field inflation is the situation where one field is dominating the stress energy of the universe. It's the only thing we integrate. And we're sort of friction dominated so that it slowly rolls down its potential. That's what we're saying here, that the friction term in the differential equation is large. To actually show this, they can compare, we can work out for this m squared phi squared condition. So previously we defined single field slow roll inflation as the situation where these parameters are small. So let's just show that the regime where these are small is the same as the regime where h is much larger than m. So epsilon is Planck squared over 2 times v prime over v is 2 over phi. Right, and then if we write, so the condition that this is much less than one is just the condition that phi is large compared to M Planck. Another way of saying, so the slow roll regime for a quadratic potential was just the regime where the actual field value of the inphoton is larger than M Planck. At one point we talked about large field versus small field inflation. The large field models are the models with detectable R, and by the Lyth bound, an equivalent characterization is that the field distance traversed by the inphoton is a few M Plancks or larger. And so what we're finding here is that this is a large field model. Slow roll inflation happens in the regime where the field traverses a few M Plancks or more. Okay, eta is the same criterion. M Planck squared over 2 times 2 over phi squared, much less than 1, is equivalent to phi being much greater than M Planck. So there's only one condition to check. And then if we write out the condition that H be large compared to M, well, H is 1 over root 3 M Planck times the potential energy, which is, let's just for simplicity pretend that we're starting this analysis with initial conditions where phi dot is 0. We just release the particle from rest at some point on the potential. So upstairs I would have rho, which is 1 over the square root of rho, which is the square root of 1 half m squared phi squared. And if that's much larger than m, that's the same thing as rearranging a little, saying that phi is large compared to m Planck. So this condition, for an m squared phi squared potential, this condition, the requirement that epsilon be much less than 1, and a, the requirement that eta be much less than 1, are all saying the same thing, namely phi is large compared to m Planck. Okay, so we know from our analysis of single field slow roll inflation that we're just slightly, what happens is that you're just slightly unfrozen. The inphoton is able to roll down, but very slowly. And W, consistently with that picture, W is slightly larger than minus 1. It's minus 1 plus a small number, which turns out, if I remember right, to be 2/3 epsilon, the leading order in the slow roll expansion. So this regime is slow roll inflation, where W is close to minus 1. Okay. Finally, what about the regime where the inphoton dominates, or this field phi, the oscillator, dominates the potential, and H is much less than M? Well, it's not hard to see that the analysis that we did for case 2 applies. We didn't actually really assume anywhere in this picture that the H that comes in here, we didn't actually make any assumptions about whether it was the H of the inphoton of phi itself or some other field. The only requirement was that it be much less than M, so we're in this adiabatic situation. So this case is actually not really an independent case, but the same as this case here. So, if you have a bunch of oscillators, if you imagine a situation where in the early universe there are a bunch of harmonic oscillators with very different mass scales, like some huge hierarchy in the M's, and suppose they all start high up on their potential, then what will happen is that the one whose energy density is the highest dominates the stress energy of the universe, and so it behaves like a single field slow roll inphoton. It sets, and as it slowly rolls down its potential, it determines the value of H. As H falls below the M's of the other, and the other oscillators are frozen. As the H of this guy falls below the M's of the other oscillators, they unfreeze and start behaving like pressureless matter. When the H of this guy falls below its own M, we're at, that's when inflation ends. We're out of the slow roll inflation regime. We stop generating quantum mechanical fluctuations, and we just behave like a matter-dominated universe. Okay, so now let's examine some reheating scenarios. So the simplest reheating scenario one might think of is the following. So let's say that the only field in the inflationary or reheating sector is a scalar field phi with a phi squared potential. Okay. So as we said before, this is a large field model. It starts at a value. So to give the right spectral index, it has to start at a value, a field value of around 10 M Planck's. Let me write out the slow roll parameters for this model. So epsilon is 2 M Planck squared phi to the minus 2. And eta is M Planck squared double prime over V, which is also 2 M Planck squared phi to the minus 2. So epsilon and eta are always equal. The little m, by the way, doesn't enter into any of the calculation of the inflationary observables, but it does determine. So the little m doesn't matter for insofar as setting the initial value of phi goes, but it does matter for determining what the energy density of the universe is. So it goes into the H, the little m goes into the H, and sets, for example, the actual value of delta zeta squared and delta gamma squared, even though their ratio and their tilts are determined by epsilon and eta. Okay. So if we compare with, if we try to match these to the observations, match these values to the observations, well, let's say we had a formula that R was 16 epsilon, and the current bound on R is 0.09 at 95%. And NS, so that gives us an upper bound on how large epsilon could be, or equivalently a lower bound on phi when our CMB scales are crossing the horizon. And NS, we had this formula, 1 minus 6 epsilon plus 2 eta. If you put in, now epsilon and eta are the same in this model. If you put in this upper bound on R, then you get a lower bound on NS, which is 0.978. And that's actually at sort of 2.5 sigma tension with Planck. So one of the, Planck, a current world analysis of CMB data, Planck plus bicep 2 plus CAC is the correct thing to say. This is also, this number is also Planck plus bicep 2 plus CAC. We're actually talking about a situation that is very borderline consistent with current constraints. It's disfavored at about 1%. I mean, maybe not totally dead, but definitely on life support. This wasn't true a few months ago, even, that it was ruled out at this level. So this is one of the more, I would say, one of the more interesting developments in cosmology recently is seeing, and for a long time we've been in the situation where we've had enough time, the error bars have been improving slowly enough that as theorists, we've had enough time to invent a huge variety of models, but the error bars were still consistent with the simplest possibility, namely m squared phi squared inflation. It's kind of interesting to see the simplest possibilities start to get ruled out, and I am very much looking forward to seeing these error bars shrink. It'll be interesting if this limit is what's going to improve. If we detect gravity waves, that's amazing. If the limit comes way down, then we're pushed into the small field, the regime of small field inflation, or maybe some of the alternatives to inflation like ekpyrosis. Okay. Anyway. back to m squared phi squared inflation. So what's going to happen is that we start here in the slow roll regime. We slowly roll down to the potential until we get to order one m Planck's. When inflation ends, h becomes comparable to the mass of the oscillator. And the inflaton starts behaving, this was our case four, like pressureless matter. It oscillates around its minimum. So the timeline of reheating is going to look something like this. Here's the beginning where we could define to be the time during inflation where our Hubble horizon today, our Hubble scale today, is crossing the horizon. We go through a long period of slow roll inflation. Slow roll inflation ends, and we get to a period of matter domination. And then at some point, the inflaton decays. We're going to give it. So matter domination, you can think of as just a bunch of non-relativistic inflaton particles sitting around. And if we give them a decay rate to the standard model, then they'll decay to standard model particles. If the mass of the inflaton particles is large compared to the mass of the standard model particles, then the standard model particles will be, the decay products will be relativistic and will therefore end in a period of radiation domination. Let me tell you some lies about reheating. I speak physicist, so the word we use for lies is something like at a crude level of approximation. What's going on? A way that you can think about this transition, the transition from matter domination to radiation domination, is like this. During matter domination, the inflaton is oscillating around its minimum, and its energy is slowly decaying. Now, you can think of that as some sort of coherent state of the inflaton, which, because it's just behaving like pressureless matter in the FRW equation, you might imagine that what we have is just some collection of non-relativistic particles. During the matter domination phase, all this business about the field oscillating around its minimum, to a local observer just looks like a collection of non-relativistic inflaton particles. With number density. Rho over M. Just decaying like a to the minus 3, just because the number is conserved. Now, if we add a decay, from phi to the standard model with some decay rate with units of inverse time, gamma. What we might suppose is that this number of particles, it's always diluting as a to the minus 3. The physical density dilutes with the expansion of the universe. And then we might suppose that You know, if I give it some decay, some rate of decay per unit time, that there's a term here like minus gamma n. Now we might also guess then that if we wanted to keep track of this situation in harmonic oscillator language, that we would just replace, so here we're just replacing 3H by 3H plus gamma. So you might guess that if we wanted to include decay to the standard model in the oscillator equation, we would just modify it by adding a gamma phi dot. And this is qualitatively correct. It'll predict the correct time scale for decay of the inflaton to standard model particles. But the truth is way more complicated. If you actually set this up in some sort of internally consistent QFT way, you know, if you say I have some background, what you would do is you would say, well, I have some background, some evolving background solution. And then I expand in powers around that background solution to get a QFT, so in this case, a free QFT. And then couple that QFT to the QFT of the standard model with some coupling, like, say, phi chi chi, where chi could denote any standard model particle. And then just start computing rates for QFT processes. What you find is surprisingly complicated. There's phenomena like parametric resonance. So modes of the inflaton field, you know, the inflaton, the expectation value of the inflaton field does decay like this on average. But what's going on short timescales is incredibly complicated. Like at a given K mode for a given particle momentum, you find phenomena like parametric resonance, where this becomes like a rational multiple, a small rational multiple of the Hubble rate. You get things like Bose condensation in the chi fields if it's a boson but not a fermion. Some incredible mess that averages out on long timescales to be consistent with the solution of this differential equation. So I won't, of course, I only have like 30 minutes left for the whole class, so I won't talk about the mess. But let's just think about this differential equation as sort of a toy model for describing the transition from matter domination to radiation domination. Okay. So we found that without the gamma term, the energy in the oscillator decays as rho dot equals minus 3h rho, which integrates to rho proportional to a to the minus 3. In other words, because this h is the time derivative of log a, the inflaton has a fixed rate of decay per log a, and so it just decays linear. It decays exponentially in log a, i.e. a power law in a. With the gamma term, what will happen is that we're adding a decay rate which is fixed in time. So this term wants the inflaton to decay exponentially in time. And what'll happen is that, you know, when h, at first h is much larger than gamma, the energy density is decaying as a to the minus 3. And then when the Hubble rate falls below gamma, the Hubble rate is a rapidly decreasing function of time, the gamma term starts to dominate. And we switch over to a behavior where rho decreases as e to the minus gamma t. Now, during matter domination, so it would decay exponentially quickly in t. And during matter domination, a is a rapidly decreasing function of t. So t is a power of a. I think during matter domination, a is t to the 2/3, so t is a to the 3/2. And so e to the minus gamma t expressed in terms of log a is like a double exponential. It's something like e to the minus gamma e to the 2/3 a, 2/3 log a. So compared to this, you decrease incredibly quickly. The energy in the inflaton goes to zero in a few Hubble times. So if we wanted to, we're only describing what happens to these differential equations in limiting cases, for lack of an analytic solution in the general case. The general picture is that what's happening, so the switch from slow roll inflation to matter domination happens when the Hubble rate falls below M. And the switch from matter domination to radiation domination happens when the Hubble rate is of order gamma and completes in a few Hubble times. This is true of both of these transitions. Just lasts order one Hubble time. The duration is order one Hubble times. Say duration. Of course, if we wanted to track the detailed behavior of the switch during this range, we have differential equations that we could integrate numerically. Now here's a fun question to ask. How many E foldings did inflation last? An E folding is one multiple of E in A, or the change in log A, if you think about log A as being a time coordinate. This is equivalent to asking where during inflation did the inflaton start on its potential? And that's kind of a fundamental ambiguity. You know, if you actually had some fundamental theory that was predicting a V of phi, then there would be an ambiguity if you wanted to translate the predictions of your theory into observations, because we don't know, our CMB scales cross the horizon at some point on this potential, where phi is somewhere on this potential, but we don't know exactly where. We kind of have a one free parameter here. And a priori, it just appears that we could put it anywhere. There's some constraints on where you can put it. There's some constraints on this number. Let's call it N inflationary. So one thing that's sort of obvious ahead of time is that we have a lower bound. Just to get the thought process starting, and this number has to be greater than, say, 10, because we only generate perturbations when inflation is active. And we see about 10 E-foldings in the CMB, the maximum scale L max, where we see CMB power, and the minimum scale L max over L min is about e to the 10. And no obvious upper bound. I mean, there would appear to be no problem with a situation where we generate our CMB scales in the first 10 E foldings of inflation. And then inflation just runs for as long as it wants. And then at some point, you know, we start the hot big bang. And there's, you know, power on this huge range of scales, but we don't actually observe those scales, so we don't really know what's going on. An interesting constraint on how long inflation can act. So a stronger lower bound and a non-zero upper bound can be obtained by thinking about the energy of reheating, or that reheating temperature in the hot big bang. The way the argument is going to work is like this. The one thing that we know about this starting point is that our Hubble scales today were crossing the horizon. So the value of AH then, power is generated at co-moving wave numbers K equal to AH. And the wave numbers where we see, you know, our CMB quadrupole, our largest observed scales today, is H naught inverse. So H naught is our Hubble constant today. So this is the one thing we know. So if we start going forward, let's say during slow roll inflation, W was approximately minus 1. So H was a constant, approximately. A was just increasing exponentially. So the value of AH here, so A increased by a factor e to the n inflationary, just by definition of e inflationary. And h didn't change at all. So this is the AH at the end of inflation. Okay, if we keep working forward, let's say that inflation lasts some number of e foldings n inflationary, and matter domination lasts some number of e foldings n md. So what happened to AH during matter domination? Well, during matter domination, H goes as A to the minus 3 halves. So the combination AH goes as A to the minus 1 half. And the value of AH decreased by E to the minus N matter domination over 2. Then we transitioned to radiation domination, and the universe was a hot plasma. The one thing that we know about that transition is that it had to conserve energy. It had to conserve the value of H. And so we can match this value of AH. This is sort of the one thing we know about the expansion history of the universe, is that we know the value of AH at this transition. But we also will know the expansion history of our universe back to an arbitrarily early point in the hot Big Bang. So we can match the AHs. So what's the AH of our universe at an early time in the hot Big Bang? I'm going to express that in terms of the temperature of the plasma. So the temperature of the plasma, AH during radiation domination, goes as A to the minus 1. So it's proportional to 1 power of the temperature. So I can write this. The temperature of the radiation in our universe today is the CMB temperature. Uh, 2.7 Kelvin. And then if I redshift back to some earlier time, AH is going as 1 power, so I get this factor. There's a little correction. This would be the right answer if the whole expansion history of the universe were radiation dominated. If you put in the matter and cosmological constant domination that happens in our late universe, it corrects it by an order 1 factor, which is something like 1/50. Roughly what's happening is that AH is going as A to the minus 1 half instead of A to the minus 1. So there's a correction by the square root of the change in scale factor between the time of the Big Bang and today, which is something like 1/50, or the time of the time of matter radiation equality, I guess would be the strongest way to put it. The one thing we knew about this transition was the value of AH, and then we can, for the initial radiation dominated plasma, AH is related to the reheating temperature like this. Now the H0 inverses cancel. And we can write this write this equation in the following way. I'm running out of space in the corner. Let's just erase this. So we've related e to the n inflationary minus 1 half n matter domination. That's that combination. If we take the log on both sides and rearrange, we get something like n inflationary minus 1 half n matter domination is equal to the log 1 over 50 T reheat over TCMB. Let me write it a little differently. I sense that I'm doing something wrong. I hear like, oh, it's just in the corner where no one can see it. Oh, yeah, the podium. Yeah, I strategically hid it behind the podium. Let me just copy the equation over here. That would also solve my problem with crowding in the corner. Okay, so this argument tracking the value of AH and relating it to the temperature of the hot Big Bang plasma shows that AH at the switch to radiation domination was given by an expression like this. Here's a better way of writing it, where TCMB is 2.7 Kelvin, which is around 2 times 10 to the minus 4 EV. So if we rearrange, we can write and we know that the AH at reheating was H naught inverse times e to the n inflationary minus 1/2 n matter domination. Okay, so canceling the H naught inverses, we can write T reheat as a number of around 10 to the minus 2 EV times e to the n inflationary minus 1/2 n reheat. Okay. Now, the reheating temperature, well, one thing we know about it is that it couldn't possibly be, let's start with a lower bound. Well, a really conservative lower bound on the reheating temperature is that it's surely larger than an MeV, or we would screw up Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which is, you know, pretty well understood and reproduces more or less the primordial abundances, happens at this energy scale. And if we came into the hot Big Bang after this energy scale, Big Bang nucleosynthesis would be badly screwed up. I don't know whether it's possible. This lower bound seems quite conservative to me. I don't know whether one can actually arrange a reheating model. You know, if you put in the inflaton, a decay of the inflaton into standard model particles, and say that it happens at an energy of an MeV, then I would imagine that you get into trouble with all the particle experiments that have been done in this at this energy scale, you know, running this reaction backwards. But I haven't thought about it very carefully. But anyway, this seems like a rather conservative lower bound, but let's just take that as the lower bound. So that gives us a lower bound on how many E-foldings inflation could have happened, a better upper bound. So this gives us the stronger bound that n inflationary, it's actually this combination is constrained to be larger than, so with one MeV here for the reheating temperature, this ratio is about e to the 20. So it's 10 to the 8, which is about e to the 20. A stronger upper bound, and the statement that it's stronger, you know, depends on the sign being negative. Now, for a lower bound, well, one thing we could say at this point, so the reheating temperature, well, it's hard to imagine that this could be larger than the Planck scale. That's one upper bound. And a better upper bound, you know, could be obtained by noticing that if there was some, if the universe was at some energy density here, then the energy density does decrease slowly during slow roll inflation, but rapidly during matter domination. It decreases as 1 over a cubed. And so if I started with, you know, an energy density here, and ran it backwards, I would infer an even larger energy density during slow roll inflation. And we actually have a direct bound on that. We know from measurements of R that the energy density during inflation, the energy density of inflation is proportional to R to the 1/4. Our current upper limits on R translate to an energy density during inflation that is around 10 to the 16 GeV around the gut scale. So that's a little bit better than M. Planck, and also a little less hand wavy, I suppose, since we actually got this number from a measurement. Okay, so if we put that in, if we put that in as our upper bound on the inflationary if we put this in as our upper bound on the reheating temperature, we would get a number around 65 here. We'd have 10 to the 16 GeV here, which is 10 to the 25 EV. Bring this over, we get 10 to the 27 EV, which is around E to the 65. Okay. Now this unfortunately isn't quite good enough. It doesn't quite work as an upper bound on N inflationary because we ended up with the wrong sign here. Like so far we can't rule out a scenario where inflation happens, what would be happening in this scenario is that inflation happens at the gut scale or lower, but then we have many, many E foldings of matter domination. Inflation lasts for a huge number of E foldings, but it still gets to happen at the gut scale because we have many E foldings of matter domination to sort of bring the energy density back to a reasonable value. But you can improve this bound a little bit just by noticing that if you actually had some energy density rho reheat here, and you ran it back because the energy density during matter domination is going as a to the minus 3, the inflationary energy density would have to be rho reheat times e to the 3/2 nmd. So if we put that in, we get to say that if we take this equation, so rho inflationary is e to the 3/2 nmd times t reheat, which is 10 to the minus 2 ev e to the n inflationary plus n reheat. Then the constraint that this be less than the observational upper bound of 10 to the 16 GeV translates to the same constraint but with the sign that we want. Okay. In practice, for some reason, so this pair of inequalities taken together combines the allowed set of values in the n inflationary nmd plane to some compact set. For some reason in the literature, people like to assume, so in all the plots, a kind of standard assumption to make is that n inflationary is between 50 and 60. I think what people like to imagine is that inflation happened at the gut scale or within a few orders of magnitude of the gut scale, within a factor of e to the 10. And that reheating is, this period of matter domination doesn't last very long. So that the NMDs are of order 1. That's really an assumption. That's really an assumption about energy scales that may or may not be true. On general grounds, this pair of inequalities, I think, are the strongest statement one can make. Okay. How much time? Oh, I'm basically out of time. All right. Well, I was going to tell you about inhomogeneous reheating, some more non-Gaussianity, but due to the usual lecture time dilation effect, I guess I'm going to have to stop here. My original plan for the class was to have half of the class be about the early universe and half of the class be about the phenomenology of CMB and large-scale structure. I think I got about two-thirds of the way through the first half. If I had more time, there's lots of fun stuff. We're actually in some way just getting to the fun stuff. I mean, I think this sort of stuff is fun. There's more, a little bit more reheating physics I could tell you about. Eternal inflation is really interesting. You know, one thing that can happen if you're on a sufficiently shallow inflationary potential is that there's a classical evolution down the potential. Because fluctuations are being continuously quantum mechanically generated, there's some quantum mechanical spread of some quantum mechanical scatter in the field values around the classical trajectory. An interesting thing, so you know, a better way to think about the evolution down the trajectory is that there's some spreading out wave packet. And what can happen is that even though, you know, at a particular point in the universe, you see some evolution, some biased random walk down this potential, the parts of the universe that scatter back uphill get to expand more. Their Hubble constant is larger. So if you volume weight things, you find that you just spread out and fill out the whole potential. That's the eternal inflation scenario where inflation never ends because there's always some finite small but finite probability to scatter back up the hill. And if you do, you exponentially expand relative to the other parts of the inflationary universe and fill up most of the volume. So a sufficiently flat inflationary potential naturally generates a multiverse, which is a super cool phenomenon. I didn't get to tell you about the effective field theory of inflation. When we studied these f of x phi models, like DBI inflation, we found that the three-point function was the sum of two very specific functional forms. There was a piece that went like 1 over cs squared minus 1 times some specific function of the three k's, and then a piece that went like 1 minus cs squared 1 minus 2 thirds gamma times some other fixed functional form. It turns out there's a general argument. So this was pretty general because it applied to any action that could be written in this form. But there's an even more general argument that shows that in any single field models of inflation, even if you have crazy stuff in the Lagrangian that we didn't talk about, like extrinsic curvature appearing, that you only generate, at least to leading order in some expansion, you only generate these two functional forms. So there's a nice, you know, even more general formalism for thinking about the non-Gaussianity from inflation that shows that the models that we considered are pretty close to as much generality as you'll ever need. I didn't get to talk about the alternatives to inflation. There are these, you know, contracting models, cyclic models, and ekparotic models where the fluctuations are generated, instead of an exponentially expanding spacetime, they're generated in a slowly contracting spacetime. If you work out the QFT of fluctuations around a slowly contracting spacetime, you'll see that it gives in other words, H is negative and slowly varying. You'll see that you can get a roughly scale invariant spectrum of perturbations just like the inflationary case. So in the early universe, I think I was about two-thirds done. And then, of course, the late universe is also full of really interesting phenomenology. I didn't get to tell you about what creates the acoustic peaks in the CMB, the phenomenology of large-scale structure, how matter fluctuations behave, and how their statistics are tied to fundamental physics, like these inflationary parameters we described, and other dark sector stuff like neutrinos. But it's just a three-week class, so I had to pick a corner. I had a lot of fun, and I actually learned a lot. I got to go through some papers, like the Maldacena paper, which I think I, like many cosmologists, would have said before the class that you know, we had read it and understood it at a high level of detail, but hadn't actually gone through it and seen all the, like we should have, and done all the calculations very carefully. So I actually learned a lot by putting it together, and I hope you guys enjoyed all this fun calculations and cool stuff. Thanks.